Welcome to Firstline. My name is Aubrey Ann Jackson, and I am a PGY1 psychiatry resident physician. In this podcast, we discuss whole person health and wellness through an osteopathic lens, holistically addressing the body, mind, and spirit. We also discuss topics important to medical trainees, including pre-med students, medical students, and residents. Thanks for joining me. Hello, everyone. I'm back to talk more about PCOS or polycystic ovary syndrome. I could talk about this all day as a combination of, you know, my medical knowledge of what I learned in medical school and even into residency, and then also all of what I've learned with my additional research since I was diagnosed with PCOS. So I hope to share some of what I know in these episodes. This is the second episode that I talk specifically about PCOS. I have an episode from last week that I recommend listening to first because I talk more about my personal journey to being diagnosed with PCOS, and I talk about a lot of the nuances with being diagnosed with PCOS. So this episode, I want to talk a little bit more about the testing for PCOS and then get into more of the treatment and management of PCOS. I know I talked a lot about looking at androgen levels and FSH, LH, but another thing that is often looked at is anti-Müllerian hormone or AMH. So this is one that I don't believe was checked when I was a teenager, but it was checked more recently on my preconception journey. And this won't be a diagnostic criteria for PCOS, but typically when women have PCOS, they're going to have elevated AMHs or they're going to be in the upper level of normal. But there really isn't a number that says, okay, if you're above this, you probably have PCOS. But for just as an anecdote, my AMH was elevated and it was outside of the normal range. And that was before I was diagnosed with PCOS. So that it at least raised the suspicion for PCOS. Like I said, ultrasounds are a part of the Rotterdam criteria with having polycystic ovaries, and that's when there is presence of 12 or more follicles in either ovary. But it's important to note that if you have an ultrasound and whoever is interpreting the ultrasound says that there's evidence of polycystic ovaries or 12 or more follicles, that does not mean you have PCOS. You do not need to go to a reproductive endocrinologist or do any sort of continued workup because it can be an incidental finding unless you also have irregular periods or you have those signs of androgen excess. So if you have any sort of symptoms, then you definitely want to pursue it. But you can be completely normal, regular periods, no androgen excess, you have polycystic ovaries on ultrasound, and that just happens normally, occasionally. And it's important to note an ultrasound is just that snapshot in time as well. I briefly mentioned this as part of my own workup, but it's definitely when PCOS is suspected, you want to rule out other things that can cause the same symptoms. So that can be things like hypothyroidism, congenital adrenal hyperplasia, androgen secreting tumors can cause, especially those symptoms of androgen excess, and then can cause a PCOS-like picture. And obviously, you would want to rule out that you have that tumor because you don't want to receive treatment for PCOS when you have a tumor. Hyperprolactinemia, which could be due to a brain mass. So that's why it's good to check things like thyroid hormone and prolactin levels and a little bit more about androgens like DHEAS. So now I want to get a little bit more into what does PCOS look like. I talked about what it looked like in me when I was diagnosed with PCOS, and I talked about how, you know, it can look very different in other individuals. And since it is a syndrome, polycystic ovary syndrome is really just a collection of symptoms that tend to cluster together to give this picture of someone with PCOS. But there can still be some variation among individuals, even though similar process is happening beneath the surface. So the manifestations of PCOS is basically based off of androgen excess and menstrual problems. So with PCOS, you may have amenorrhea, so no periods, like how I was early on, or you can have something called illegal amenorrhea, where you just have less periods, and that's what I kind of saw in myself after I came off of the pill. And then with that, you can have the same thing with ovulation. You may not ovulate at all, or you can sometimes ovulate. And another thing that you can find is that with this menstrual irregularity, there is often an elevation of luteinizing hormone. So usually with this, FSH, or follicle stimulating hormone, is normal or even a little bit decreased. So it knocks off the balance of that LH versus FSH, and you have an elevated LH over FSH ratio. But this isn't part of the diagnostic criteria, though it can point to why that irregularity is happening. And all of these factors kind of come together to lead to dysfunctional follicle development. And it's important to note also that women with PCOS, when they do become pregnant, if they're able to become pregnant, they often have higher risk of different complications, which is up to 40% higher than the total population. So this can involve elevated risk of miscarriage, of developing gestational diabetes, having preeclampsia, or just hypertension during pregnancy. You also have a higher risk of needing a C-section or having a premature delivery. And I was fortunate enough that during my pregnancy, I didn't have any of these complications, but at the same time, I knew that I was high risk for it. So maybe knowing that, I was even more on top of going to my prenatal appointments and doing everything that I needed to do, taking my prenatal vitamin and, you know, making sure that I am managing my stress well. So it doesn't mean it's going to affect everyone, but you have to be aware, and your providers during pregnancy have to be aware as well. So the clinical symptoms of PCOS can differ among individuals. I know that I talked about hirsutism a few times. This is, you know, thick body hair in a male distribution. You can see it on your upper lip, your chin, on your chest, and then the lower abdomen too, where women often get the linea alba during pregnancy. So all of that is kind of male pattern, where women don't usually have hair, but men usually will have hair. And then you have that increased risk of obesity and insulin resistance regardless of weight. You have an increased risk of fatty liver disease and sleep apnea, as well as increased cholesterol. So all of those factors can come together and increase your risk of a ton of other things like coronary artery disease. Also important to know, it increases your risk of mood disorders and eating disorders. So now I want to get into the treatment for PCOS. I'll first start out by saying it's going to differ based off of what your goals are. Some women want to become pregnant, and so ovulating regularly is going to be a main goal of theirs. While other women may not be trying to get pregnant, and they just want to manage their acne and their hirsutism. Other women maybe have a really hard time losing weight, and they're HbA1c is now in the pre-diabetic range, and they want to decrease their risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And for many women, it's a combination of a few of these goals, and sometimes all of these goals. And maybe they have a whole different goal too. So it's very individualized. But the first thing that I'm going to mention is that lifestyle changes are super important for PCOS. And a lot of times, lifestyle changes aren't going to They're not going to eliminate PCOS. You have PCOS, but lifestyle changes can make a huge difference in symptoms and long-term prevention of worsening symptoms and the development of other diseases. So for many women, diet and exercise is going to be super important, especially if you're in that overweight or obese BMI. You want to get your weight to the healthy range between 18.5 and 25. And for a lot of women, that makes a huge difference in their symptoms. However, many women with PCOS, including myself, are within that normal range, that healthy range BMI already, and we're having symptoms. So in that case, losing weight isn't going to make a difference, but diet and exercise will still make a difference, because you can have a completely crappy diet but still not take in the number of calories to necessarily gain weight, but you still have a crappy diet and you're not getting the nutrition that your body needs and you're just putting junk into your body. So in that case, diet changes are super important. And I did that myself when I was trying to optimize my fertility and I wanted to start ovulating. I did a lot of diet changes and some of them were even adding higher caloric foods. Like I worked on increasing my fat intake because I'm someone who is vegetarian. So I felt like that was a place that I could improve my diet because I was having a lot of carbs in my diet, and for some women, you might have to increase your carb intake, but for me, I had to increase my fat intake and modify the carbs that I was taking in, reducing the amount of sugar, but increasing the number of whole grains that I was incorporating into my diet. So there is a podcaster who is the host of a podcast called As a Woman. Her name is Dr. Natalie Crawford, and I just want to give her credit to of this idea and just say that I completely agree with her, but I just wanted to say that, you know, give her credit because she talks a lot about this and I really appreciate it for a lot of her patients. So she is an REI, so a reproductive endocrinologist, which is in OBGYN subspecialty, and she really talks a lot about not necessarily a vegetarian diet but a plant-based diet and mostly reducing the amount of meat, and she really recommends to only have meat once a day and to only have red meat like once a week and to kind of follow basically what is a Mediterranean diet. And I definitely agree with this, and I just want to carry forward that recommendation. That is a really good diet for the vast majority of people, to have more of a plant-based diet, either meat once a day or completely vegetarian, and to follow a Mediterranean diet of plenty of whole grains, plenty of fruits and vegetables, plenty of healthy fats, but then also at the same time, you know, if it's your birthday, enjoying a slice of cake and just focusing on making good decisions the majority of the time and not following any kind of restrictive diet like keto or paleo or thinking that you have to buy all of these crazy supplements and protein shakes and things like that. It really is quite simple. And it sounds easy, but it's actually quite hard. But I think it's important to focus on the little changes that you can make, can add up. And it's not as glamorous as some of these diets, but it is the best thing that is out there, is this more Mediterranean diet of making the decisions you probably already know are the best decisions, but actually sticking to it and just deviating from what is known as the American diet of a lot of processed foods, a lot of sugar, a lot of salt. So anytime you veer away from that, you're doing your body good. And so this is the diet that is especially super important for anyone with PCOS. Part of this also is exercise. So for most women, increasing exercise is going to be the move here. For me, I was a long distance runner. I would often run for longer than an hour a day. And for me, I thought that was too much. So when I was trying to optimize my fertility, I actually decreased my amount of running. I started walking instead, and I kept to more around 20 to 30 minutes a day instead of my over an hour of running a day. But for most women, you're going to have to work on increasing that exercise instead of reducing it. So another thing to keep in mind about PCOS is that, yes, it is often managed with oral contraceptive pills. However, oral contraceptive pills seem to mask the symptoms of PCOS, which for some women is really good because it's going to help with your acne, your hirsutism. But it's important to know that you still have PCOS under the surface. You still have these metabolic changes. So don't think that, oh, I take the pill and now my symptoms are going away. I don't need to do anything else. It's really just masking those symptoms, but it can help to regulate your period. Of course, it's not going to work very well for you if you're trying to get pregnant, because it's obviously going to prevent pregnancy. But for some women, this is the move to do. There's other options too, like you can do the progestin releasing IUD. If you really don't want to be on oral contraceptive pills, you can reduce your risk of endometrial cancer by taking the mini pill every few months to induce a period so that your endometrium doesn't keep building up without bleeding. And that's if you have that oligomenorrhea or amenorrhea, because it's important to not go too long without a period. Metformin is one that you're probably going to hear a lot if you have PCOS. That is very often given, and it can actually help with restoring your menstrual period. It's successful in up to 50% of women, and it also helps you to lose weight, and it helps with that insulin resistance. It's less often given to women who have that normal healthy range BMI and women that do not have any signs of insulin resistance. Like I said, oral contraceptive pills can help with hirsutism, but there are other options available, such as spironolactone is often used to treat hirsutism in women with PCOS. But there's also other agents available too, like finasteride, but your doctor will help you with this. You just have to tell them about the symptoms that you're having. And of course, there's also other things available, like you can shave, wax, use laser treatment for hair. Often women that lose weight will see that their menstrual cycle becomes more regular, but that is really only if you have that overweight or obese BMI. It's estimated that you really only have to lose 5 to 10% of your body weight to induce that kind of change. And then, of course, if you do have insulin resistance or type 2 diabetes, there are many other medications that you may want to start for diabetes in addition to metformin. If you are a woman with PCOS who has high cholesterol, you may want to start a statin, and that will help to reduce your cholesterol. If you have sleep apnea, which women with PCOS have an increased risk of sleep apnea, then of course you want to get a sleep study evaluation to be formally diagnosed, and then you may have to start something like CPAP. If you are trying to become pregnant, again, weight loss can cause a dramatic shift in your menstrual cycles and ovulation if you are in that overweight or obese demographic. And then if you're still struggling, or if you are of a normal weight, then there are ovulation-inducing medications such as clomiphene citrate or Clomid, which was the one that I was on, and I had to go through several different cycles. Metformin can also help with ovulation, but letrozole is seen as the most effective medication for this purpose. I did go on letrozole for 1 month, but I never had a positive ovulation test, whereas I was a little bit more successful on Clomid. Of course, when it comes to fertility, there's always other options beyond that, such as trigger shots and IVF. So that is the basics of treatment for PCOS. I think it's important for anyone to know what the treatments are like, especially if you're in the healthcare field or if you're affected by PCOS. Now you can ask your doctor about specific options for you. View the show notes for additional information about this episode and access the link to First Line's website. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to First Line on your favorite podcast app to hear a new episode every Monday. Thanks for listening.